Greetings, mortals. This is Dormammu, the ruler of the Dark Dimension. With admittedly sad news this week, the hosts of Into the Weird are apparently too busy to provide a show for you weirdos out there. But never fear, my good friend Ragador, Rax, as I like to call him, has asked me to provide a show for you to fill in for those lazy half-wits. And what a show I found. Taking a cue from the Watcher's playbook, I've managed to plumb the sordid depths of the multiverse, and I've come up with quite a gem. From an alternate reality, if you will. And that gem, all polished and shiny, I present to you right now. A what-if scenario, if you will. What if Billy D was known as Billy DC? What if Herman, advocate of Marvel, suddenly became a disciple of DC Comics? Well, listen in and find out what I mean as I present to you a little something called Into the Bizarroverse.
Welcome to Into the Bizarroverse, a podcast looking at the craziest, the kookiest, the zaniest stories from the DC Comics of yesteryear. I'm your host, Billy D, and alongside me is my co-host, Herman Highfather Lowe. How are you, Herman?
Hey, Billy, I'm great, man. Thanks for having me on the show yet again. Another week, another show where we discuss DC goodness and the bizarreness that we so love from the old silver and bronze age of DC. So how have you been, man? What have you been up to?
Not a whole lot. Trying to keep it cool here. Had a horrendous week of work, so enjoying some downtime.
Ah, same here. You know, I kind of wish that, you know, we would go back to that sort of idyllic era that the DC Silver Age heroes sort of existed in. You know, guys like Hal Jordan, Barry Allen, you know, where they live these perfect lives in this beautiful suburbia, because, you know, things are not like that. You know, things are more, the way things are in the world these days are more like the Marvel Universe, which is chaotic and all messed up, like from the 60s, families squabbling amidst, you know, best friends, like stealing, you know, girlfriends from each other. You know, this is the kind of thing we have to deal with, yeah. But no, things are going well. I'm excited because, you know, we're talking about two great issues, one of them being one of my childhood favorites, and also probably the issue that made me fall in love with DC weirdness, you know. And you also had a great pick. Again, listeners, like we always do, we have two issues that we're going to be discussing on Into the Bizarroverse. Billy, I'll let you go first, just introduce the picks that we had. What was your pick for this week?
Okay, so mine is The Batman Family number 2 from 1975. This is, it's total reprints, no new material here, but all stuff that is insane. And I mean, especially the lead story, which is what we're going to talk about. Batgirl breaks up the dynamic duo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, crazy story that just makes absolutely no sense. So it fits in perfectly. And then you are going to be covering...
I'm going to be covering DC Superstars number 12, which does feature one reprinted story, an old Superboy tale from the 1950s, but it also has a new tale written by Cary Bates and penciled by Kurt Swan, which sort of takes a lot from that old story, that old Superboy story, which is in fact included in the at the end. You know, and then they should have actually included this in the beginning, maybe, because some people might be confused, but we'll get to that. But the new story that is featured is the wackiest and the weirdest and the kookiest. So, yeah, we're going to be discussing that one last, but we'll get to the Batman issue first. All right, listeners, so Billy introduced the issues. I'm just going to talk a little bit about this era in DC. This is the mid-70s here. I think both of these issues were, well, the Batman Family one was in 75, right, Billy? Mine was in 1976. A lot of these DC family titles, like Superman family titles and Batman family titles, they featured reprinted material, but also some new stories. And they were sort of, the stories were very simplistic. It wasn't like Neil Adams Batman or dealing with any social issues, you know, like the Green Arrow, Green Lantern title. This was more harkening back to the Silver Age, good, clean, family fun. But if you read it in retrospect, you know, with a perspective on you know, current day, it's so crazy and so inappropriate in most cases. And that's what we love. That's why we're here. That's what we're doing Into the Bizarroverse, right? Yeah. So we'll get to that, Billy. But okay, we'll start this off with our normal synopsis. Are you going to give us one for the main story of the Batman family, number two?
Yeah, this one is, like I said, it's called Batgirl Breaks Up the Dynamic Duo. And it's written by Gardner Fox with pencils by Carmine Infantino, inks by Sid Green, and letters by Milt Snappin. All right, so I'll just get right into it here. The issue begins with Robin betwixt Batman and Batgirl as they're both asking him to join them for action. We switch scenes to an earlier time, and we see Batgirl on her sleek motorcycle as she chases down some crooks that just robbed a museum. She's doing quite well for herself, but Batman and Robin show up to help. As Batman intervenes, he slips and falls into the swamp. Batgirl and Robin have to help him out. As the heroes talk, Batgirl notices that Batman doesn't look so good. She tells Robin, but he's skeptical at first. She uses her detective skills and photographic memory to deduce he has swamp fever and that he doesn't get the proper rest. He'll collapse while fighting a villain and get hurt. She then devises a plan to lure Robin away from Batman and solve all the crimes in Gotham to be his guardian angel. After stumbling and almost getting shot by a crook, Batman finally relents and takes some time off to get better. The end.
Oh, man, what a brilliant premise. If you think about it, this is classic Silver Age storytelling where you have to get around the comic book code, can't show too much violence or blood, so you have to come up with a story that will make the kids, you know, feel engaged. But what a tale, right, Billy?
You know, yeah, like, I mean, it makes no sense.
No sense whatsoever. But, you know, on the cover, you can already see that this is one of those typical Silver Age covers that we're normally used to, even though this Bat Family giant, as they build these issues, was published in the 1970s. We have the typical cover where something crazy is happening, you know, like Superman pouring water in the desert with Aquaman and Jimmy Olsen crawling after it, or Lois Lane, you know, kissing another guy and Superman lamenting the fact. You know, those classic yeah. Silver Age covers. Now here you've got Batman and Batgirl in a tug of war with Robin as the rope.
Yeah, it's just insanely bizarre. And then it's almost like a picture frame. And then it does have one of my favorite things, no matter what comic book company we're talking about here, is the floating heads. So on the left margin, it has Alfred, yeah. Vicky Vale, the Clue Master, and Mystery Man. So all of those other characters were in the other backup stories. They weren't in the main story, but that's still something I had to get out there because I love when comic books do that. They have the floating heads on the covers. But
floating head covers are the best, especially when, you know, it appears on a let's get the team together, you know, issue, you know, like those Avengers or some of the, you know, the Titans stuff from the 70s had them too. And you know, what I like, though, before we get into the story proper, like you already gave us a synopsis, but there are four tales in this comic book, right? And each of them have some titles that really will engage my interest right from the get-go, because there's stuff like Batgirl Breaks Up the Dynamic Duo, which is the one we're going to be talking about. The second one is the Dynamic Trio, which features this mystery man guy. And then, you know, the Clue Master's Topsy-Turvy Crimes and Alfred's Mystery Menu. Those are the tales. You know, we can quickly mention some of them before we get into the main tale. The Dynamic Trio is interesting because it features this mystery man guy. We're not going to be talking about this tale too much, Billy, but do you quickly want to tell people who is this mystery man?
Yeah, so like when you look up a synopsis online, like just a one-liner, it says, Batman declares he needs help to crack a smuggling ring, so much for the world's greatest detective, and brings in a new hero called Mystery Man. And then Vicky Vale spends the whole story trying to figure out who Mystery Man is. And she actually does figure out who it is in the end. And it's, are you ready for it? 800-year-old Commissioner Gordon.
He's leaping over buildings and vaulting, you know, like chimney stacks and stuff like that, along with the dynamic duo. Like, it's nobody's business.
Oh, yeah.
I'm telling
Beating the crap out of, like, crooks half his age and stuff like that have guns and stuff. Oh, yeah, it's ridiculous.
Oh, man, this is crazy. This is crazy. Not even Batman Year One, you know, Navy SEAL Batman Year One Commissioner Gordon could do that.
No, really, not really. Man. Oh, and then if we didn't say already, I don't know if we might have forgot, Gil Kane and Murphy Anderson were the cover artists.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
Kane did a lot of covers in the 70s, and we're fans of his covers. Murphy Anderson, great inker, worked primarily for DC. And I really like this cover. I like the way Batgirl is drawn because, whoa, she's very, very sexy, and she's drawn alluringly. Batman is drawn to resemble his Silver Age look, you know, and Robin is drawn like a kid as well. So this is definitely, you know, obviously Gil Kane went with the fact that this is reprinting Silver Age stuff mostly. So, you know, that's why the cover looks like it is, but it's a great cover. I like it. I like the perspective too, you know, Batman in the background, Batgirl in the foreground. You know, and Robin in between them. He's like, his feet are actually off the pavement. You know, he's like literally hanging in the air as this rope between them. It's great.
Right, like when a mother and father are walking through a mall or whatever, and they have their little, like, toddler between them, and they swing their kid up and down so their feet don't touch the ground. That's what's happening with Robin here, like he's a five-year-old.
Now, Billy, unlike a lot of the covers from the time, especially the Marvel covers that we got from Marvel. You know, if you and I were Marvel fans primarily, we would probably have more knowledge of this. But what I remember of the Marvel covers of the time is they would tease an image that is never featured within the comic book proper. But listeners, this cover image actually does happen in the pages of the comic. It almost happens exactly like this Tug of War.
it's really crazy.
So we're going to get to that just now. All right, Billy, let's talk about this. You gave a brilliant synopsis. I want to talk about the craziest parts of this comic. First off, you know, something that struck me is Batgirl. She gets a lot of the spotlight in this comic right from the beginning. She's developed this technology. She's hiding like a traffic cop behind this giant advertisement,
roadside
billboard. And then she waits for criminals to drive by. And then she, you know, pursues them with this magic, this multicolored light tracer beam that she's developed, that she's put on the front of her bat bike, which sort of is tuned to the vibrations of every individual car that passes her by, making her able to track any car anywhere.
Yeah, no matter how far ahead it gets. So if she sits there for an hour and they get 60 miles ahead, she can still find them.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Oh man, that's insane. That's already some Silver Age madness there. And then you've got you know, this museum guard that's been thrown out of a moving car by the criminals who kidnapped him as a hostage after they robbed the Gotham Gothic Arts Museum. So you kind of think, what kind of stuff did they rob? What, like a, you know, like a rack for ancient medieval torturing, you know, like finger presses? What else? You know, like maces and all of that kind of stuff from the... and, you know, they got away with it, and Batgirl's pursuing them after she hears from this guard. And then, of course, she has to go through a swamp because a bridge has collapsed, and she shows her off her acrobatic skills, which is something I like. But she also trash talks the criminals quite a bit, right? For some reason, yeah, they got across the bridge, but they decided to wait around for her to get stuck in the mire with her bat bike so that they could blow her away, right?
They could attack her, yeah.
Yeah, but she vaults over the rail, over the handlebars of her bat bike, Evel Knievel style, right? Or should we say, mm-hmm, you know, to piss off the Marvel fans, Johnny Blaze style. And she somersaults into this guy's face. Boom!
Dropkick, yeah.
Dropkicks him in the face. And then she takes on the rest and she shows off her judo skills. Now, I love this bit, you know, where she sort of, she fights them, but she's constantly got this big smile on her face, like she's enjoying the heck out of this.
Oh, yeah.
And then they get the better of her, but she's not worried because for some reason she knows that the dynamic duo is hot on her heels. And it's true, they show up in the Batmobile, Batman and Robin. And then just at that right point in time, she sees, oh, they're not going to make it across the swamp. You know, so there is a lever, though, that lowers another bridge or lowers it out of the water. I don't know how this is working. But she flips the guys with some judo techniques into this lever with the sound effect of whoop. And it looks like that lever is almost hitting the guy in the crotch or something, or on the thigh. And then the bridge is raised and the Batmobile can cross. So what happens then, Billy? The funniest, well, one of the funniest parts in this comic book. Oh, man, it's
so
insane.
Batman jumps out of the Batmobile and punches a guy in the face, which is great. But in the meantime, he slips on like a rock and falls face first into the water.
Oh, damn it. Oh, and continue.
And then Robin and Batgirl have to pull him out. And he says, "Brr, this water's cold. Why am I shivering? Or this water's not that cold. Why am I shivering?" Batman saying, "Brr."
Brr. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's even some exposition, you know, as if we don't see clearly what is happening. You know, he says, "My foot slipped. I'm taking a header into the swamp waters." Boom. He looks like he's slaking his thirst on the swamp water, which it's not drawn to resemble swamp water at all. I mean, this is not Swamp Thing's kind of swamp in the Louisiana bayou. This is more like a clean, clear, crystal clear river.
Right. And I'm not sure if you look on the very next page, the very first panel, I'm not sure what Infantino, Green, and whomever the colorist was, which I can't find who that was. But the next page, that very first panel, they're standing there talking, the three of them. And Batman looks like somebody threw an egg off the side of his head. He's got something. Like, if that's supposed to be water, it's like
damn,
pink and white. It doesn't even look like water. So I don't know what that's supposed to be off his sliding down the side of his head, his cowl.
Yeah, no, it's insane. The inker on this issue is Sid Green. Yeah, a guy called Sid Green. I know him. You know, I can't really form an opinion of his inking style. You know, he like you say, there's some discrepancies in his inking here. But, you know, I mean, he's not the Vince Coletta of DC by any means.
Yeah, no. Overall, he's okay. Yeah, overall, this is okay. Yeah. It's not bad. But, yeah, it just looked weird to me. Like, what the heck is that? Is that supposed to be water coming down the side of Batman's head? It doesn't make sense that it's pink.
That's definitely weird. Yeah, so, you know, inking goes a long way, man. We know that, you know, from stuff we've discussed in the past. But, you know, here, some panels, like you say, look a little bit wonky, but others are fine. You know, I can't really form an opinion. Basically, it looks like any Carmine Infantino penciled comic I've ever seen, really. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unless, like you say, he inks himself. I think we talked about that off mic. Sometimes he does ink himself. Mm. We'll get to that, listeners. We'll get to that. But, you know, there's a couple of great action scenes here, though, because the action is so strange. You know, the punch that you mentioned, when Batman clocks that guy before he takes a header into the swamp water, that's totally his fault, because look at that weird position his body was in, right? Yeah. He's not throwing his weight into that punch at all. You know, he doesn't put his shoulder into it. There's no rotation of the torso. He's completely like... It's basically a Carmine Infantino punch, you know, and he's definitely going to fall, you know, splash. He doesn't, obviously takes a header, but I don't know how he got from that position, Billy, of the punch panel into the header, into the swamp. You know, he should have fallen on his back or something, the way he's positioned. And yet,
yeah, how he ended up on his face, we don't know.
Plants his face into the murky waters there. You know, so then, you know, Batman, he has a funny hue on his skin, right? His skin is going gray. He feels that he's shivering, like you mentioned before. Batgirl notices something off. Robin doesn't notice anything. He'd have thought he would, you know, being, you know, running with this detective for a couple of years at this point in time, right? But he notices nothing. Batgirl, this is totally her issue. She immediately says, Robin, something's off with Batman. We've got to keep an eye on him. And then, you know, Batman already, like, feels some, you know, ire here, because he doesn't like it. It turns out he doesn't like Batgirl and Robin gabbing, you know,
whispering,
to each other.
Yeah.
And we'll see some jealousy crop up later, folks, but it's going to get crazier. It's going to get crazier.
It's kind of creepy if you think about it. You know what I mean? Like, if Batgirl and Robin are supposed to be similarly aged, you know, and Bruce is how much older than them? Why would he care if they were talking together or hanging out together? It's kind of creepy if he's like going to fight Batgirl over Robin. It's creepy.
And you know what's even worse is Batman, he comes later on, he comes to a conclusion that would be logical to us, which we'll get to, listeners, but in the Silver Age that he's operating in, it's completely illogical. We'll get to that later, listeners, but because of this, why is Batgirl and Robin hanging out, he comes to this conclusion that you and I would come to, you know, and the world's greatest detective will certainly deduce this. But of course, this is a Silver Age, so the conclusion is totally illogical for the Silver Age. You know what I'm talking about, Billy. We'll explain just now, listeners. But you know, as it turns out, Batgirl, she in her you know, alter ego, her secret identity of Barbara Gordon, she's a librarian at this point in time, right? She researches Batman's symptoms later that night or the next day. I think it's the next day. And she's in the medical research section of the library, and she realizes Batman's got swamp fever based on these symptoms she's observed. Now, that swamp fever, Billy, is instantaneous, because literally right after he face-planted himself in the swamp, she noticed the symptoms, right? So she deduces that there's 7 days left before he completely collapses, and that will cause him to get killed by whatever criminals he's hunting at the time. And she needs to act as his guardian angel. Now, don't you think she would have better served Batman by just telling him right away, hey, you've got swamp fever, buddy? No, she has to take the Silver Age approach to the situation, shadowing him, stalking him, and Robin, bringing Robin in, you know, it's on this crazy plan of hers.
Yeah, she basically says that she's gonna, like, get Robin to tell Batman he doesn't want to be partners with him anymore. He wants to be partners with Batgirl, so then Batman will try to, like, hang it up. Course he's Batman, so we won't hang it up. So then they figure, well, if he won't hang it up, we're just going to run around the city and figure out all the crimes before he does, and, you know, beat up all the crooks before he gets there, so there's no chance he might get hurt.
Yeah, exactly. So what is this doing to Batman's self-esteem? Well, we'll find out, listeners. This is definitely not good for Batman's, you know, ego here. You'll see what we mean. So, you know, first off, I want to mention a panel that's pretty great, you know, dialogue-wise and, you know, action-wise. The very first time Batgirl shadows Robin and Batman, you know, they're attacking these crooks in this hideout, and the ringleader escapes, right? So Batgirl is waiting for him in an alley, and she tackles him. And as she tackles him, she says, listen to this, listeners, talk about ego. The Green Bay Packers lost a great linebacker when they didn't pick me for the draft. Oh, God. And then Batman immediately... Now, this is where it gets strange, right? She apprehends the ringleader right after Batman says, oh, no, he escaped. And then rather than congratulating her or saying, good work, Batgirl, which is what Batman is wont to do, he gets jealous right off the bat, right? He says, another chance meeting. You know, like, what is she doing here? So he's upset that she nabbed the ringleader. This is not the Batman we know. Or the Batman, the way Batman should be. And then, Billy, this infamous tug-of-war scene happens. What happens in the police headquarters or the police station after they bring the hoods in? What happens?
Well, so Batman is talking to probably Chief O'Hara, I would imagine, or whoever that is there at the desk. And he notices Batgirl and Robin are having another little rendezvous, a secret conversation. And he says, ready, Robin? And then Batgirl whispers to Robin, just follow my lead. And remember, it's for Batman's own good. And she goes, Robin, I just had a brilliant idea. Why don't you and I team up together? And Robin says, Ray V. Batman says, you mean you actually go for the idea? Come on, we've got work to do. And Batgirl, make up your own mind, Robin. And then they both grab Robin and start pulling on him. Like in a tug of war, like on the cover.
Oh, man. And Robin says, oh, let go, Batman. Batgirl and I go together like ham and eggs or hot dogs and mustard. Batman's like,
Batman, will you cut out this foolishness?
Oh, my God. And Batgirl then, you know, she plays her trump card here, insult-wise. She says, don't you get the message, Batman? Get lost. And then the tug of war commences. Hands off, Batman. From now on, it's Robin and me.
And Batman says, you've lost your senses, both of you.
Oh, my God. And then, you know, eventually Batman relents because he feels that Robin is actually working against him. He's not just this limp piece of rope. No, no, no. He's actively trying to get Batgirl to win this tug of war. So he's like, all right, if that's the way you want it. And he relents. But it's so bad.
And his head's dropping like he's you know, having a bad day. He's like, down, oh, no, poor Batman.
Oh, my God. You know, so mopey. Oh, man, he's mopey. Yeah, he's mopey. And, you know, then, you know, listen to the thought balloons. Because back then, of course, listeners, the thought balloon was very important. You know, we had thought balloons. I love them. I don't know about you, Billy, but I love having inner monologues and thought balloons.
Oh, yeah.
So we're privy to Batman's thoughts. And what he's thinking is, after Robin and Batgirl arrange to meet up the next night for some crime fighting, Batman, he's obviously overheard where they're going to meet, which is at the police station. He thinks, I'll be here too, if only to see how Batgirl plans to go about it.
Yeah, like he doesn't think they can get it done, so he's going to watch out for them.
Definitely.
Okay, Batman.
That's right. So then we've got Robin's thought balloons. We've got Batman's thought balloons. Both of them are thinking things. They're not speaking to each other, obviously, on the ride home, because now there's some, you know, the tension in the air is you can cut it with a lightsaber. And then, you know, actually, I shouldn't
Batman,
say you can.
Batman immediately thinks it's sexual.
Yeah. Okay, now this is what I'm saying. This is a logical deduction, right, Billy? Because in normal parlance, this would be fine. You know, obviously, why does Robin want to hang out with Batgirl? Because he's got a crush on her. You know, that's what Batman's deducing. No. Silver Age Batman should know better. This is way more convoluted, way more complicated than this, Bats. You should know. Just from observing the Superman family alone, you could see that this is not the way Silver Age stories normally go. You know, so...
Right.
We get treated to this panel because obviously it's logical, right, Billy? Okay, yeah, he has a crush on Batgirl, you know, Robin. That's why he wants to hang out with her. But then things get weird.
Yeah.
Now, in the very last panel on that page, I think it's page 9 of the comic, right, Billy? You've got the next morning, presumably. I mean, these guys never sleep.
The following evening.
the following evening. Before they hit the streets, or Robin's going to hit the streets with Batgirl, Bruce Wayne is reading a newspaper, and you'd have think Batman would do a better job, but look at the headline of the newspaper.
Crime wave in Gotham.
What the hell is being Batman even helping? No, there's always a crime wave every single night. Oh man, and there's no bat signal here, folks. They get their heads up straight from the newspaper, the Gotham, you know, and it's just called the Daily Paper or something. It doesn't even have the Gotham City Gazette or anything.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, then, Dick has the audacity of asking Bruce for a ride to the police station to meet up with Batgirl. Bruce has to drop him off like at a prom.
At a date.
And then, oh man, the nail's in the coffin now. Batgirl's just, you know, like pouring salt on the wounds here. What happens on the very next page? What do we see, Billy?
Batgirl shows up with a sidecar with Robin's logo on it, trying to go on patrol with her.
Oh man, the final straw. Batman just, he can't believe it, man. And Robin even says, "Are you going to wish us luck, Batman?" And he says, "Sure. Luck, what else?" Still like pouting. Oh man. And then Batman, yeah. This is the worst thought balloon a bubble in the entire, you know, comic, because this shows how pathetic this Batman is, right, Billy? I'm saying this Batman because this is not our Batman. No. As they ride away, Robin glances over his shoulder and says, "So long, Batman, see you later." And what does Batman say, Billy? In this thought balloon,
he goes, "Even at the last moment, I thought this might turn out to be a gag, but no, it's really happening."
Oh man, this is like the ultimate breakup here. You know, like he's losing his kid, he's losing his partner, he's losing his, you know, according to Dr. Frederick Wortham, his love interest. Anyway, and they make good on what they said. Like, Batman is following them around. He's also still trying to stop crimes. But the entire night is filled with Batgirl and Robin taking out these criminals, lickety-split, and Batman showing up too late. Mm-hmm. And it happens the entire night. You see, you know, Batgirl tripping people, Robin, you know, dive-punching people. You know, there she's showing off her judo. Robin's sitting in the sidecar in a very weird way. He's sitting with his butt on the armrest.
Yeah, ready to fall out.
Oh, man. And then every time Batman shows up, they're quickly whispering to each other, Robin and Batgirl, saying, "Has the swamp fever taken effect yet?" Oh, man. And Robin's saying, "It should hit him sooner rather than later. I can't take much more of this." And then, you know, we're treated to a panel in Bat Mansion, in the Wayne Mansion, where, you know, Batman's got this very sad look on his face. His frown, right, Billy? And yeah. And he's trying to, they say even in the dialogue boxes, or in the caption boxes, right, Billy, they say Batman's actively trying to derail the team up between Robin and Batgirl. He's even saying, yeah, "Oh, you can't go out with her tonight. You've got homework to do." And Robin says, "Oh, sorry, we don't have any homework. Tomorrow's a school holiday." And Batman's like saying, "Oh, how can that be? This is not a national holiday or anything." He says, "No, the teachers are on a conference." And then
conference.
what does Batman say? He's like,
"Oh." He has this look on his face like he's gonna cry.
But then what
Batgirl said was gonna happen finally does happen. You know, they're beating the crap out of a bunch of crooks, but there's one that's still like semi-conscious, and Batman comes in and falls on his face and almost gets shot in the head. And Robin and Batgirl have to save him, and then he's laying there unconscious.
And like, holy sadism, Batman. Listen to this sadistic little prick Robin rubbing it in. Every time Batman shows up too late for a crime, finding them at the crime scene first, Robin's like, "Good to see you, ex-partner." Jeez. What's up with this bastard, little kid? Anyway, and then, you know, it goes on like this until they finally get to a crime where Batman, sleuth that he is, master of deduction and super smart crime fighter, he decides he's not just going to follow them around. He's going to do it the opposite way, right? He's going to change his route. He's going to go from the other side of the city first. which they you know planned for, but it turns out that they got there right after Batman did then, right? Because this was a little bit unexpected, but not wholly unexpected. He turns up, he's beaten up a few crooks, and then he succumbs to the swamp fever, I believe, just in time for a crook who's been playing possum so that he could get a chance to blow Batman away. This might have happened in any way, swamp fever or no swamp fever, right, Billy?
Right.
Because he's been playing possum to get the drop on Batman. Batman collapses just as this crook wakes up with the gun in Batman, pointed at Batman. And then luckily for Bats, you know, his guardian angels show up with some weird sound effects punching out this guy. Zwat and clop. And this is the very last page of the issue, listeners, because what happens is Batman's, you know, he's laid out by the swamp fever. And then this great little panel where Robin says, Batman lasted the full 7 days. Why?
That's kind of creepy.
And then Batgirl says, because he's in such perfect physical condition. And they take him to the hospital and, you know, he's lying in bed in his Bruce Wayne guise now, right? And Commissioner Gordon shows up, leading Batman to wonder, well, has he deduced my secret identity, or has Batgirl and Robin told him? It turns out, luckily, no. But the very last panel is such an anti-climax, right, Billy? What happens there?
So they take Batman to the hospital, but then, like you said, Bruce Wayne's there, and he says, we brought you... Wait a minute, who is that? Is it Commissioner Gordon is with Barbara and Dick? And Commissioner Gordon says, we brought you a rare treat, Bruce, Chinese oranges. And he goes, odd, I've been reading up on swamp fever, and Chinese oranges are especially beneficial in helping one recuperate from swamp fever.
And that sets him to wondering.
Yeah, he says, what do you make of it, Dick? Is it possible that after all these years, Commissioner Gordon suspects I'm Batman? And Dick says, wouldn't that be something? He has a smarty pants look on his face.
Little bastard. I'm telling you, the sadistic sidekick of his. No, man, this story's the craziest Batman tale probably ever. I mean, you think Silver Age Batman goes crazy. Yes, it does. Even in the 50s. Late Golden Age Batman goes wacky, but this stuff, Billy, man, this one you picked, I'm telling you, it's a winner. You know, when I own the issue, I've owned it for a couple of decades now, but, you know, reading it now with our Into the Bizarreverse mindset, it's even crazier than when I remembered reading it way back when. In fact, I can't even remember reading it because I don't know if you're at that age, Billy, or at that level of mental faculties where I'm at now, because there's literally some stuff I own that I can't remember reading.
Oh, you know? For sure. Yeah, yeah.
Even
absolutely.
Even though it's from an age where I did religiously read everything I bought, you know, it's only now, you know, that it's come to the, you know, with graphic novels and trade paperbacks and stuff like that, it's only now come to the part in my life where I've got the stack that I have to work through. But back then, when I bought comics, I would immediately read them. You know, even if I bought like 20 at a time, I would finish them in a day or two. You know, but nowadays, obviously, no. But yeah, I can remember reading this comic way back when, but it's so crazy, so zany.
Yeah, I mean, Batman's Swamp Fever. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, this is written by, like you said, Gardner Fox, but it's more like a Bob Haney story, right? Zany Haney.
When I first looked at this and I didn't realize... Like, I must have just, like, went blasting right past the credits because I didn't even see it was Gardner Fox. And I thought to myself, oh, it's got to be, you know, Haney. And I saw Fox, and I'm like, wow. And I read the rest of the stories, too. And like I said, other than the one, the whole book is all Gardner Fox. And some of the other stories are pretty crazy, too. Not quite on this level, but they're wild, too.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, Gardner Fox, we associate him with smart writing. You know, he would always have like a mystery and a way that the hero has to solve that mystery in a very original and, you know, interesting way. But this is not the Gardner Fox we're used to. Not this weird, wacky, crazy, you know, Gardner Fox who comes up with these insane stories. I mean, he did have some pretty crazy stories in the Silver Age. But this one takes the cake, man. This is probably the craziest Gardner Fox story of all time. So
it is for me that I've ever read, for sure. Yeah, without a doubt.
No, man, I have to thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed this issue, Billy. I'm so glad you selected this for our, you know, into the Bizarroverse main segment here, because it's a winner, man. That's why I wanted you to pick to talk about this one first, because I think it might even be slightly superior to the one I picked.
Oh, this one's crazy too, though. I can't believe how it ended.
The tug of war alone. Huh? The tug of war. Oh, man. Which actually happens. That's insane. And Batman reacting the way he does with jealousy, with... I mean, you could say this is a symptom of the swamp fever. I doubt it. This is a symptom of the Silver Age.
Yeah, creepiness. Yeah, it was just weird how he was like... And I think to myself, why would there be a problem if Robin wanted to go, like, on patrol with her for a few nights or something like that? He's like adamantly against it, like, you can't, you're my partner. And I'm like, okay, dude, like, you're getting a little possessive here of a little boy, like, calm down. Like, what a creep. Like, what are you doing, man?
Yeah. And he even tries to, like you say, like, he tries to play the dad card, you know, at one point in time, saying like the parent card. Yeah, the homework. You can't go out. But he's letting him go out every other night, you know, with him. Yeah. Homework be damned.
Uh-huh. But if it's only if he wants to go out with a girl, you can't. Okay.
He's worried what they might get up to. Ah. Uh-huh. Yeah, but I mean, there's definitely no... I mean, later on, Nightwing, yeah, he becomes the horn dog when he's joining the Titans and stuff like that. You know, later on when he becomes Nightwing. Much later. But, and then even worse, in the 2000s and late 1990s and 2000s, he becomes like a womanizer, like... serial womanizer, I think. But now, I mean, he's definitely written as a kid, you know, and Batgirl's way more mature than him. I mean, he's in junior high, probably, while Batgirl is already a woman, a librarian. Working woman. And she's got a PhD, you know, so what? She must be 10 years or 15, I don't know, 10 or 12 years his senior by this time. There's no way. Okay, Batman does think this is a little schoolboy crush, whatever. But the way he's reacting is like two teenagers going off on their own, doing God knows what. That's the way he's reacting, the way he's treating it. Anyway, man, it's insane. It's just crazy. Chinese oranges, Billy. Chinese oranges.
Yeah, how about that? What does that have to do with anything? Like, who thought of that?
Next time you get swamp fever, bud. Buy some Chinese oranges.
I'll have you send some over from Asia. Maybe they'll make me better. You know, we'll see.
I'll try. It might be in a terrible condition when it gets there, but we'll know. And with the trade war going on, we don't know what'll happen. Oh, it's brilliant.
Oh, man.
And then...
All right, so what about Superboy here? Let's take that on. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe this one either.
Okay, yeah. This one's insane. This is one of my childhood favorites. I read it way back when. I think I picked it up in the early 80s, very, very early 80s, when I was a kid. This is one of my favorite issues about featuring Superboy. You know, the classic Superboy, pre-crisis. Obviously, we'll never talk about the post-crisis Superboy on this podcast, listeners. Never fear. But, you know, this Superboy, written by Cary Bates, you know, penciled by Kurt Swan, inked by Murphy Anderson. This is my Superboy. I like him. You know, I prefer The New Adventures of Superboy, which was done by Cary Bates and Kurt Schaffenberger. That sort of made me fall in love with the Superboy tales from the Bronze Age, but it was very much Silver Age inspired, those, you know, New Adventures of Superboy. Yeah. But I love Kurt Schaffenberger, and I love all these old guys that used to pencil the Superman family. You know, we're talking here Wayne Boring. We're talking, of course, the big granddaddy of them all, Kurt Swan, you know, godfather of Superman penciling. A lot of people seem to hate on Kurt Swan these days. I don't get it.
I love him.
I mean, obviously, I have my favorite Superman pencilers, which is probably... Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, you know, I love him. He's my favorite Superman penciler. But, you know, Swan's in my top three or top five at least. You know, I would say definitely.
He's my favorite Superman artist, yeah.
I mean, he's so iconic when it comes to illustrating Superman. I don't get all the hate. I mean, obviously, just like Kirby, he had some weird... I mean, I would say his anatomy overall is better than Kirby's, but what I like about Kirby is his crazy anatomy. But, you know, what I like about Swan is his style was always consistent, you know? Even though he did draw Superman a little bit, you know, not very dynamically, you know, all of his fight scenes would be the same, you know, weird punches and stuff. But I love that. I associated that with Superman at the time, at least the 1970s Superman. And then when I went back and reread the old Legion of Superheroes Tales, you know, when I bought the archives of that, featuring a lot of Kurt Swan pencils, I loved that too. You know, because when he draws a thinner Superman, a Superboy-esque Superman, he bulks him down a little bit, right, Billy? I like that look. I like that look too. It's like you can clearly see the difference, but the resemblance is still in the face, right? You couldn't always see that with the other artists that worked on Superboy in the 50s and 60s. You know, sometimes he would not resemble Superman at all. He looked more like Peter Pan or something.
Yeah, he looked really like, I don't know if frail is the right word, but not like a super strong person for sure.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's the way I should have put it. Yeah. So, you know, this one is one of my favorite issues. Because of that, I've always been a Superman fan, and I've always been a Superboy fan because of the Legion, but also because of, you know, his tales from the Silver Age, which is so crazy. And this one, especially DC Superstars number 12, this was published in February of 1977, even though the on-sale date was the previous year of 1976. Mm-hmm. And it was 48 pages, featured two stories, edited by Paul Levitz. And then... cover penciled by Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson. It shows Superman punching out a Sasquatch. Superboy.
A Yeti, yeah.
He punches out Bigfoot and a UFO flying in the background. But it's this great, you know, kind of Kurt Swan-ish punch with this roundhouse. He always drew roundhouses, you know.
Yeah.
And then, well, not always, but, you know, most of the time. And this poor Yeti, man, the surprised look on his face is just, it's classic.
Oh, yeah, and then we find out the Yetis really have nothing. They really are not deserving of a beating here, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, that doesn't act, I mean, it almost happened. Something worse almost happened in the pages, you know, but this basically also reflects something that's going to happen in the comic, right, Billy?
Yeah, I mean, this is insane. Yetis are even like, that's insane. Superman fighting a Sasquatch. But there's something way worse in this comic we'll get to.
Yeah. Definitely. So the team, the writing team on this one being, of course, Cary Bates. He's known for writing, you know, dozens of Superman tales throughout his career. He's you know, ever since he came to prominence in the 60s, I think he's been working for DC. He sent scripts when he was a kid, right, Billy? He was like 13. He was like kind of like Jim Shooter.
Yeah.
You know, he would send scripts to DC when he was 13, and then he got... work there at a very early age. But this story that we're talking about in this DC Superstars Giant number 12 is entitled Don't Call Me Superboy, right? Whereas on the cover of the comic it says it's called The Final Test. This is actually the first story called Don't Call Me Superboy. Now, Billy, after I do the synopsis, I just want to let the listeners know, after I do the synopsis, I'm going to quickly interject with, you know, another tale, which is featured at the back. But we're not going to talk about that story. I'm just quickly going to introduce that character, which is very important to this first tale, featured in the second tale in this book, which is a reprint from an old Superboy story from the 1950s. So let's get into the synopsis first. The tale of Superboy called Don't Call Me Superboy. All right, our story opens as reporter Clark Kent and his best friend Jimmy Olsen are flying back from an assignment abroad in their guises as reporters, of course. And then, while they're on the plane, Clark seems distracted because they're flying over his hometown of Smallville. And Jimmy comments on this before a very attractive stewardess comes up to them and asks them if they need anything else. And, in fact, you know, tightens Clark's seatbelt, and Jimmy comments on what a looker she is. And after that, Clark seems even more distracted. After the stewardess arrived, he then focuses on the town of Smallville that they're flying over and uses his telescopic vision and X-ray vision to peek into the kitchen of his old house, the Kent house. And then he goes for a walk down memory lane, or should I say a flight down memory lane, where he remembers a tale featuring himself as Superboy. It starts at breakfast one morning when Clark seems unusually distracted, and his parents, Jonathan and Martha, comment on this as he eats breakfast at super speed. Jonathan even says, "Wow, Clark, only a couple of dozen pancakes for you this morning? What's up with this kid?" And as it turns out, the reason for Clark's haste is he's meeting up with someone who has he's been obsessing over of late. And it's brilliantly teased that this might, of course, be Lana Lang, the ever-present girl in Superboy's life in Smallville in those early days. Unfortunately, this is not what it turns out to be, unfortunately for Lana, possibly. It turns out that Superboy's obsessed with someone else, but before we find out who, an alien UFO arrives, a flying saucer that blasts the Superboy statue on top of Smallville High to smithereens. This prompts Superboy to immediately streak up into the air, leaving Lala standing flabbergasted. And he pursues this UFO into the stratosphere, but all of his attempts to catch it turns to naught. Eventually, he figures out a way to do this after deducing that it absorbs cosmic radiation. He traps it in the ionosphere, in the ozone layer, and then superspeeds around it, creating a barrier of ozone, which blocks its absorption of cosmic rays, and then he plummets into this barrier that he's created, smashing through the hull, and before he finds out who was in fact flying this flying saucer, it explodes. Superboy is knocked for a loop, and then it turns out that this is a familiar face who piloted this UFO. In fact, it is the super teacher from Krypton! a robot, in fact, right, Billy? Who was created by Jor-El to educate his son. And who, in fact, has done so in the past. In the old Superboy tales, he showed up to educate Superboy in the use of his Kryptonian superpowers. Now he's returned, after leaving for space on a sabbatical, to provide the final test for our Superboy. As he's maturing now and ready to leave high school, the super teacher of Krypton has returned to make sure that his teachings have taken root. Then we cut to a dance as the super teacher disappeared, and it's time for Superboy to meet up with someone that he's, you know, that's going to play a very important part in this story, folks. Superboy is dancing with Lana, and then Lana then discloses that she has delivered a note that Superboy requested her to deliver to a very special someone. So as to now, we had thought that this special person taking up all Clark's thoughts has been Lana. No, in fact, it turns out to be a girl called Misty. Lana says, "Sorry, Clark, Misty will never fall for you. She's the hottest girl in school." "No, Lana, you're wrong." Misty cuts in to the dance and then requests a dance with Clark. And it turns out that she quite likes him because the note that he wrote for her pointed out to her that he was totally different from other guys in the school. And that she, in fact, finds him attractive. Then retreated to a short cutscene where it seems that the super teacher of Krypton has used some high-tech illusion machine on Superboy, which forces him to believe that he's in a fight with the super teacher of Krypton in the gym. But as it turns out, this was all just in his mind. He's in fact dancing with Misty and they're falling in love. So she wants Clark to walk her home and then gives him the obligatory goodnight kiss. But that's not the end of the night, folks. No, her folks are not at home. So she leads him into their house for some hanky-panky. Well, as it turns out, that might well be the case. She shows him a secret that she's deduced from the letter he wrote her. She's a handwriting expert, and it turns out that she's analyzed his handwriting, showing a strong and confident person. This leads her to believe that he has a secret identity, because he's someone he appears to not be, in fact. And it turns out that she has deduced that he is, in fact, Superboy, based on off of his handwriting alone. She takes off his glasses and gives him another kiss, and they spend the night together. The next day, Martha and Jonathan are worried because Clark didn't show up at all for breakfast. In fact, he hasn't even slept in his bed. He hasn't been home. They think he's off on doing his superheroics. No, that's not what he was doing. So then they spend some time together, and they fall ever deeper in love. But something terrible happens. Some Sasquatches come to call. They tear up the town. Smallville's being subjected to the Sasquatch rampage of the century. Superboy shows up. He, defeats the Sasquatches in a very humane way by tying them up with his super cape. And then it turns out that they were, in fact, captured and escaped from a circus. They were recently captured in the woods of Smallville. by a circus owner who is billing them as his star attractions. Superboy won't have this. He won't have these poor creatures being slaves to the circus owner, so he uses his super breath to blow them away, and then leading the circus owner to think that they have the powers of flight. So Superboy blows them into the woods, and they escape, heading back to their homes. And at that moment, the super teacher of Krypton shows up, saying that there is a test that Clark has to pass, and he's yet to pass this very final test. Just at that moment, Misty shows up, running through the fields towards Clark. But, unfortunately, one of the younger Sasquatches, scared by never having seen a human female before, picks up a stone, hurls it, and knocks Misty on the head, leading Superboy to think that Misty has died. He attacks this Sasquatch, intent on murder, when he passes his final test by saying that even though this creature killed the only girl he ever loved, he can't take a life, not even for this. This elicits the praise of the super teacher, who reveals the truth that Misty has in fact never been enamored with Superboy. She had been hypnotized by the super teacher of Krypton to believe that she was in love with Clark. In fact, now that she's been hit on the head, she remembers nothing of him whatsoever. And that leads us to the end, where the flashback is over and Clark Kent, as the reporter, is again stuck on an airplane seat looking out, and the stewardess turns out to be the self-same Misty from years and years ago. And that ends the story as we know it, making Clark comment on the girl of his dreams. So that's the end of the synopsis, listeners. The most horrific story I've probably ever read, but also the most interesting and probably the saddest. What do you think about this one, Billy?
Yeah, this is crazy. I mean, we've seen in other, like Marvel books in the Silver Age, where you have like somebody like Professor Xavier being an absolute maniac and just mind wiping people and, using his powers very indiscriminately. And I mean, this super teacher robot guy from Krypton, like, holy crap, did he ever go over a line here with, what he did in this book. This is the craziest thing ever, making, Clark think that a Yeti killed his girlfriend.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I didn't want to put too much detail in the synopsis because, listeners, the full effect of this is basically, yes, like you say, the Yeti killed his girl. Clark was led to believe that. But the worst thing is, the super teacher admits that he picked this girl from another town. Basically, he kidnapped her. Her name's not really Misty. He hypnotized her to believe that her name is Misty, and to believe that she's a handwriting expert, and to believe that she's a student at Smallville High. And the reason he picked her is because he used his supercomputer brain to analyze that she has the exact traits necessary for someone with the personality of Clark to fall in love with her. So he not only manipulated the situation, the events, he manipulated emotions as well. Through super hypnotism, he said that putting this girl in Clark's path would have made it impossible for him not to fall in love with her. So,
right, and then after it's all over, my favorite line of the robot is, "I will return her now to her own town so she can resume her own life." I thought, what?
Exactly.
How long has she been gone for? How long has this been going on? And I'm thinking that you're just going to take her back now? And it's, oh yeah, resume your own life. You got whacked off the head with a friggin' rock the size of like a fist. She needs to go to a hospital, you idiot.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, Billy, think about this. Basically, this is, I think, where Superboy lost his virginity, because they definitely spent the night together. They definitely spent the night together. He stayed with her that night in an abandoned home. We don't know what home the super teacher selected.
Whose house was that even? Yeah.
It's an empty home. It's not an abandoned home. It's like a home that's, probably no one's living in.
Like
right?
For sale or
it's
something.
It's for sale
like
because he made her believe that she had parents who lived in Smallville, but they were out of town, right? And that's where she was staying. That's where the super teacher of Krypton kept her, this kidnapping victim of his. And then, the worst thing is this, Billy, think about this one. Since she was hypnotized to be a totally different person, a person called Misty, Clark then fell in love with her. She fell in love with him. They slept together. This was not really consensual on her part. if you think about it, right?
No, this is like a freaking Bill Cosby like thing here.
With the super teacher like, as Bill Cosby. Yeah.
Yeah, he like gave her like roofies or something.
Yeah, with his super hypnotism. This is terrible.
Yeah,
this is
what a creep.
The implications are terrible.
Bad, man.
This is really
crazy
bad.
Crazy bad.
This is really bad. But now, okay, listeners, you might think less of me. Why do I say this is one of my favorite comics? Well, I mean, if you think about it, the super teacher did say that Misty has the exact personality traits mathematically calculated to appeal to Clark and vice versa. So she really did fall in love with him too.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. Yeah. So that sort of makes it better, but not really, because he wipes her memory of the event, even though she did also truly fall in love with Clark and he fell in love with her. He wipes her memory of the event. He doesn't wipe Clark's memory of the event, which leaves him traumatized, because now the girl of his dreams turned out, you know, he could never have her. Plus, the test that the super teacher wanted him to pass was that he wouldn't kill an innocent creature who killed the girl he loved. You know, so that's the test that the super teacher wanted him to pass. And to do that, he set this story up. He set this whole scenario up for Clark to fall in love with this girl and then wiping her memory to make her completely forget him. You know, which is horrible. You know, but
maybe
also,
you know what? Maybe the super teacher inside that robot, maybe it's just like a costume. And Lois is actually inside there to get
Silver
back
Age
at him
Lois.
for all the super dickery.
Oh,
she's
man.
Getting back at him. Yeah.
Oh man, that's horrible. Now, Billy, this is the thing. Now, okay, so he's obviously now present day. He's Superman. He's Clark, the reporter. Mm-hmm. He's flying on this airplane. He sees Misty. This is what triggers the memory, because the stewardess who shows up is the actual girl of his dreams, the Misty he fell in love with in Smallville as a teenager. This is her. And now, okay, he is in love with Lois at this point in time. Well, we think, right? So this might be the reason he doesn't pursue this. But if she is the girl of his dreams, why doesn't he do something about it? You know, he just says, the stewardess says, you know, I noticed you've been staring at me all through the flight with the strangest expression, as if you know me. And then it just ends with Clark saying, Miss, would you believe me if I said you were the girl of my dreams? So what happened after this? We never see Misty again. You know what
I mean?
You
know what happened? I can tell you exactly what happened. Misty and Clark joined the Mile High Club. That's what happened.
Oh, man. Hopefully not in the, you know, like Ralph Fiennes with the stewardess in the, you know, in the aircraft bathroom.
The toilet, yeah. So that's what happened.
It's possible.
And this time it was actually consensual, too. So it was okay.
Yeah. Well, the first time it was consensual, but, you know, in a weird way. I don't know how to square that, really. You know, Billy, I really don't know how to square that. I mean, is she really a handwriting expert, or is that also part of the hypnotism? What part of her personality was true? We don't know. This robot teacher could have completely simulated everything, you know?
He needs to be disassembled. Like, this is what I love what he says on his way out as he's taking Misty back to wherever he kidnapped her from. He says, I manipulated your emotions, Kal-El, but it was required. Now I can leave you forever since you have proven you're a super boy worthy of, and he says, don't call me super boy. After what I've been through, I deserve to be called a man.
A man.
There's two
ways you could look at this, Billy. Yeah, because he passed.
Or
because he you know, he popped his cherry.
He boned Misty, yeah. Oh my gosh, what were these guys thinking?
Double meaning, Carrie Bates, I don't know where he pulled this story out of. I mean, holy crap. You know, and you said the super teacher of Krypton, this robot, should be disassembled. Jor-El, the blame should be squarely laid on Jor-El's doorstep. He invented this guy.
Crazy.
So listeners, then the story following this is the original tale where the super teacher of Krypton first appeared in the pages of Superboy, way back when in the 1950s, where basically the super teacher he came to Earth. He revealed that he was created by Jor-El, and he instructed Superboy on the use of his superpowers. But he didn't do anything reprehensible this time around, Billy. He just gave Superboy like normal tests, like hurling boulders at him, testing his invulnerability by sending him into a volcano, that kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then also testing him how he would deal with the fact if his secret identity had been outed.
Identity was revealed. Yeah.
So, you know, nothing to play around with his emotions, nothing to manipulate other people. You know, what he could have done, I mean, with super technology, this is possible because Superboy creates Superboy robots, right? The super teacher of Krypton could have created a super android or something of a girl or something and not given her AI, just made her, you know, just a normal blank slate and then programmed her. And he could have tried to do it that way. But instead, he kidnapped a real live girl, you know, forced mm-hmm. them to fall in love with each other, then took it away again at the end. I mean, it's horrible. And, you know, like you say, what about her parents? What about the town he kidnapped her from?
Were her parents? Can you imagine that? Her parents probably think she's dead.
Exactly. Yeah. Because she must have been gone for a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, dead or God only knows what. You know what I mean? Like your daughter was kidnapped and you, oh, I don't even want to think about this craziness.
Yeah,
like,
man. And what about the rest of the people in Smallville that had dealings with her? The teachers, the students, Lana. Well, Lana must have said, where the hell? What happened to her? You know, like, well, I don't know. What, did the super teacher hypnotize everybody else too? Probably.
We'll be back after a quick break.
It's time to take a ride down the audiobook trail.
I am John McClane. Welcome to the podcast. I ended up discovering the world of audiobooks and thinking, you know what? I've found my spot. We'll do bloopers because I have thousands of them. I love a good story. And, you know, I have to admit, as far as vocations go, this one's pretty cool.
This is the Audiobook Trail Podcast.
We're going to drop a 30-minute episode every 2 weeks. Audiobooktrail.com.
Possible.
Well, he would have had to, because you figure she's a student, a new student at the school. What do you do? Hypnotize like the admissions people and everything else? There's a new student here. Like,
this story has so many far-reaching effects, but they never deal with it again. But think about it, Billy. This is so traumatic, you know, for Superman and Superboy. And then I don't know, man. This is just horrible. I think I recall another story from the Silver Age where Superman, you know, he. I think it was where Supergirl tried to set Superman up with different superwomen across the galaxy because she thought that he was lonely. So she set him up with this girl called Luna Lane. She was a superwoman from also the double L, right? From another universe. And then he fell in love with her, but it turned out that they could never be together because when she came to Earth, her powers would fade under the yellow sun, but only under her purple sun would she have her powers. So they had to separate and... He was heartbroken then, you know, so, I mean, this stuff happens in the Silver Age and apparently, according to Gary Bates, in the Bronze Age too. This crazy stuff. Oh, man. But Billy, no, good story. But
so good.
Yeah, your Batman tale is definitely my favorite because this one has some scary implications that I don't like to think about. But when I was a kid, I liked this tale because it had this bittersweet ending, you know, with Clark meeting up with this girl. You know, that she doesn't know about this chapter in her life at all. But, of course, he was left with the memories, probably because the super teacher wanted to torture him. He's probably friends with Brainiac or something.
Spent many a night in the Fortress of Solitude sobbing over this.
Yeah, man, I definitely. And this Fortress of Solitude will feel even more lonely after this encounter, you know. Anyway, this is the first and only instance of Superboy sleeping with someone, I think, you know, in the pre-crisis. Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is the girl that he lost his virginity to. I think, I mean, I'm not sure. It could have...
And you figured, too, this is even a few years before Superman 2 when he hooked up with Lois.
Yeah, definitely, man.
So
definitely.
In any media, this is the first time Superman got any...
Damn, it definitely, there's no question about it, Billy, because they spent the night together in that place after she showed him the slides and the handwriting and everything, and he didn't come home. I mean, Jonathan Martha the next day commented on that. They thought he was out all night doing super heroics. Nope.
All night patrol.
No way.
He was laying the super pipe.
Now think about this, Billy. Think about this. This could have gone, this is also reprehensible in another way. The super teacher of Krypton, he set up the Sasquatches as well. You know, those three, the family of Sasquatches that he allowed to be captured by the circus owner and allowed to rampage through Metropolis because they were scared. They were innocent, dumb creatures. And then he potentially wanted Superboy to murder one of them if Superboy failed the test, right? That was the test, seeing if Superboy would murder this innocent creature. And somehow he manipulated through super hypnosis. He also manipulated the fact that this Sasquatch will attack Misty at the right moment when she comes running up to Superboy. You know, this guy's a master of this, you know, human chess. You know, we're all
manipulation.
Everybody's just his chess pieces. Yeah, he's a master manipulator. So he needs to be, like you say, disassembled or destroyed or, yeah, seriously. So, yeah, listeners, write into us. Let us know what you think, because this story, man, it disturbed me, but I enjoyed it. And that's also disturbing in itself.
Absolutely.
All right, listeners, we're going to take a quick break. And when we'll be back, we'll talk some DC do's and don'ts. So don't go away.
Beginning in 2018, the Who's Who podcast enters the 1990s with our coverage of the Loose Leaf editions.
Featuring Superman by Jerry Ordway.
The Joker by Brian Bolland.
Wonder Woman by George Perez.
Sandman by Mike Dringenberg.
Batman by Norm Breyfogle.
The JLI by Adam Hughes.
Eclipso by Bart Sears.
The Legion of Superheroes by Keith Giffen.
Dark Stars by Travis Charest.
Lobo by Simon Bisley.
Kent Shakespeare by Chris Sprouse? Who is that?
Doomsday by Tom Grummett.
Wait, are we covering these by issue or in alphabetical order?
The Justice Society of America by Mike Parabek.
The Forever People again? You are f***ing kidding me.
Doom Patrol by Richard Case.
I'm so confused.
And many more. The Who's Who podcast, going boldly into the 90s.
A proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I guess.
All right, listeners, we're back with DC Do's and Don'ts. What we liked and didn't like about the comics under discussion. I'll let you go first, Billy. The Batman issue. What are some of your DC Do's and DC Don'ts over there?
Well, for my DC news, the insanity of Batman and Batgirl fighting over Robin. That was just, I just loved that. Like you said, a tug of war, and then how Batman was getting all snarky and didn't want Robin. He didn't want to share Robin with Batgirl. It was creepy, but it was so funny. Like, that was the best part of it for me. I mean, without a doubt, like, the rest of the stuff, you know, there was some funny panels and dialogue, you know, him slipping and falling on his head in the swamp and stuff too. But that, just the overall craziness of
the tug of war.
Oh, yeah. Like, no, he's going to be my partner. No, he's my partner. That was just hilarious. I love that.
Oh, man. Okay, mine has obviously a link to this. It has to, because the whole issue features a Batman who's completely acting like a little 12-year-old girl who's getting her best friend stolen from her by another girl. But for me, it's pouty Batman, you know, pouty Batman sitting around, moping around, wanting to somehow throw the spanner in the works here to try to stop Batgirl and Robin from hanging out and teaming up. But, you know, he's moping around, and the thought bubbles, the thought balloons just, you know, supports that, because he's constantly complaining in his head about them. And, that's my favorite part of it. The panel showing his sad face.
His inner dialogue.
Oh, man. That's just not the Batman we're used to seeing. But, you know, it is kind of in line with Silver Age or late Golden Age Batman, you know. So these things happen, folks. Depending on the writer, obviously, they had to make these stories, you know, sort of toe the line, which at the time was keep it kid-friendly, keep it, engaging, keep it entertaining. And this, for some people, apparently this was entertaining, you know, seeing how Batman would deal with the fact that Robin's no longer his partner alone. And he doesn't deal with it well, Billy, not at all. Swamp fever, no, Batman, notwithstanding. Yeah. He's basically a little girl about this whole thing. Okay, I'm not insulting all girls here. I mean, when I was a little kid, I also got upset when my best friend started, you know, showing interests and stuff that I had no interest in. But, you know, still, he's basically like my sister was when she was 12. Oh, man, this is crazy. Yeah, that's my DC do's. What about your DC don'ts concerning this issue?
Well, for sure, I mean, it has to be I don't understand. Like, why couldn't Batgirl just join up with Batman and Robin and tell Robin, you know, hey, you know, he's sick, you know, we're gonna have to look after him? Why couldn't they just do that? Like, why did they have to, like, you know, why did she have to, like, quote unquote, steal Robin so they could go and, you know, fight all the crimes before Batman gets there? Just like, say, oh, Batman, hey, can I join the team? You know, there are plenty of issues where Batman, Robin, and Batgirl work together. Why couldn't they just do that, work together, and then, you know, take care and make sure Batman wasn't, you know, it, when he falls over from swamp fever, they'd be there. You know, I mean, it's just, it's crazy. It makes no sense.
Communication. You mean they should have just told him the truth? They should have just told him what they found in the medical journals. He's got swamp fever. He would have, he's Batman. Come on, he wouldn't have let his ego, well, maybe he would have, the Silver Age Batman. He would still insist on crime fighting, but at least he would have the support of two people who would watch his back. You know, without them having to go this, you know, long winded route, you know, this behind his back. Yeah, so yeah, that's a crazy bit of logical inconsistency there, right, Billy? For crazy. For me, it was the art a little bit, you know, like we'll get to that in our blasphemy segment, which is coming up later, folks. But the art here had some very strange poses on behalf of the characters. And it also had some, I mean, but it serves the story well, right? Because this story relies on some comedic beats, right, Billy?
Yeah, but for sure.
There were some really strange panels here. You know, Robin being drawn like a very small kid, whereas at this point in time, he should have been in his late teens. He's still looking like little 9-year-old Robin, you know, in some places. And then at other places, he looks a little bit bigger. Yeah, I can't fault the art too much, but it was definitely my least favorite thing about the issue. I also don't like the way that they drew Bruce. You know, whenever you draw Bruce Wayne, you kind of have to get him right. But, you know, okay, Bruce Wayne would never have this pouty face, even though that's the thing I love. You know, right. Alfred too. Alfred has the exact same expression as Bruce. You know, that high frown lines and Bruce looking like, actually, he looks like he's, you know, like, I don't know, like he's been hypnotized as well by the super teacher from Krypton. Oh, man. So I'm not a fan of the art, Billy, but I'm going to go into specifics later when we get to our blasphemy segment. But yeah, that's my DC do's for this issue. Let's get to the Superboy issue. What are some of your DC do's over there?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wish you could sip cocktails and discuss great books with your friends while hanging out in a rundown piano bar? Here on the Literary Guys podcast, that's what we do. I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kellyan. Each month, we discuss books from two different views of modern masculinity.
From both a gay
and a straight perspective.
From To Kill a Mockingbird
to future governors in the jungle trying to kill a predator. We welcome everyone to join our conversation on the good and toxic of what literature and pop culture have to say about masculinity. So pour yourself a drink and join us now for Season 3.
Literary Guys. That's G-U-I-S-E. LiteraryGuys.com.
I see what you did there.
Well, for sure, the thing that stood out to me the most about this issue, or I'm sorry, the story, lead story in this issue, was the artwork. Mm. I mean, Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson, it's just like the splash page, the first page you see is incredible. I mean, it shows, you know, I'm trying to think of what kind of a term you use for this, where it shows like Superman, but as a baby and then growing up in the different stages from left to right. And then, you know, far right is, you know, he's fully grown, I guess you would say, as Superman.
Yeah.
And he's like kind of in the middle in the picture that's in the forefront. But oh, I thought the artwork in this was beautiful. I mean, to me, Swan and Anderson are, you know, they're one of the classic great artistic teams of the DC, you know, Silver and probably even early Bronze Age too. But yeah, for me, it's all about the artwork in this one. Crazy, crazy good.
Oh, good choice there, Billy. Now, mine has a link to this again, but it's not the artwork specifically. Mine is that Cary Bates, either knowingly or unknowingly, wrote a story that's very, very important in Superman mythos. If we're talking about the overall mythology of Superman, this story is seminal. Do you know why, Billy? Because this is the story that shows the exact moment where the transition between Superboy becoming Superman happened. The exact moment. Now, we might not like how he got to that moment, right? Obviously, courtesy of our loving super teacher from Krypton, compassionate as he is, we might not like how he got to this moment, but this shows the exact moment where Superboy became Superman. Because he, in fact, says it. Don't call me Superboy anymore. The story title says this, and he says it at the end. I'm not Superboy anymore. Now I'm a man. I'm Superman. And yeah. And like you say, the splash page reflects that, because that's where it ties into the art. You've got Super Baby. You've got Kindergarten Superboy. You've got Young Superboy, Preteen Superboy. Then you've got Teenage Superboy, which is the one standing in the foreground, which is featured. He's right in the middle, featured in this story. And then you've got Superman as a young adult, Superman in his early 20s, and then current, you know, adult, mid-30s Superman.
Yeah, like 35 or something. 35, maybe, yeah, 35.
Like they've established his age should always consistently be, right, as an adult. So, you know, you're right. This is the art tied in with, obviously, the impact of the story, which is this changeover between Superboy and Superman. So, yeah, this is actually a big deal, you know, in the overall Superman canon, which is something that is not talked about often, because, in fact, this story is not referenced very often because of all the disturbing implications. I mean, over at Marvel, you've got the Carol Danvers giving birth storyline to basically her rapist's kid. Here, it's almost as bad as that. It's almost as bad as that. But DC did a better job of sweeping this under the rug, right, I think.
Yeah,
so that's
it. You don't hear anybody talk about this issue along with Avengers 200, thank God.
No, thank goodness, yeah. I mean, it's almost in the same vein.
It's not far off,
This one has largely been forgotten, which is now a shame because I'm bringing it back to light. Oh, man. Jimmy's such a horn dog in this issue, Billy, man. I mean, I'm looking at the next page now that, you know, he's checking out the stewardess's butt. Oh, man. So so for feminists, obviously, this issue would have a lot to criticize. And we are also, you know, criticizing it because of that. The representation of women in this is just atrocious, right? They're just kidnapped victims and or stewardesses meant to be ogled. It's horrible.
Yeah, I mean, the Batman issue, you get some agency with Batgirl there, which is cool. But yeah, this Superman one, man, forget it. This is awful.
So maybe I should amend the fact that this is my favorite Superboy issue, you know, but it's not for these reasons. It's because it's a product of its time and it's so crazy. And they deal with these issues in such an offhand manner, and the implications are so far-reaching. That's the only reason it's one of my favorites. And also because of the art and all of that. So let's talk about that, Billy. Like, what are some of your don'ts regarding this issue?
Well, there's only a couple things. Like, of course, I mentioned earlier, like the super dickery. Like Clark, man, he's sitting there and he's completely blowing off Jimmy. You know what I mean? Like he's he even starts to look out the window and zoom in on Smallville and Ma and Pa Kent there, he's just totally blowing off Jimmy. Like he doesn't even realize there's somebody in the seat next to him, so he's kind of a jerk there. And then this super teacher, he hypnotizes these three Sasquatches, and what does he make them do? He doesn't make them do anything even remotely horrendous. One of them just turns a car over, the other one bends a street lamp, and the other one, my favorite, jumps on a trash can. And that's what he makes them do to get Superboy's attention to stop this, you know, murderous rampage, which it's not. It's just, they're just almost like hooligans.
Well,
they should have been like threatening people, like trying to kill people, go crazy. Like, what? That's
well, I mean, we don't know that for a fact, Billy. I mean, they might have murdered Oscar the Grouch, you know, with that trash can leap, but no, I know what you meant. Yeah. I'm telling you. I mean, what would have happened if the Smallville police force, Chief Parker or whatever, right? The only police officer available always, this old guy.
Yeah, ever.
What if he pulled out his sidearm and started shooting at these things? I'm sure they would have gotten hurt or turned more murderous or died. You know, so the super teacher, he just didn't care. Lucky for him, he seems to have the ability to mathematically manipulate probabilities or luck, because it seems to turn out cherry. But, you know, it could have gone the other way based on his callousness. Yeah, so you're right. That's a bit of heavy super dickery there on the part of Superman, the super teacher, and indirectly Jor-El.
Yeah, really. They could all be traced back to Krypton and Jor-El here, really.
Oh, man. Oh, it's horrible.
Craziness. What about you? What do you got?
Okay, yeah. For me, it's going to be roughly the same. I'm just going to word it a little bit differently. I, you know, obviously don't like the way that they, you know, treated girls in this. I mean, Lana herself is just a messenger in this story. You know, normally Lana's like, she is treated as a spoiled little brat, you know, but normally she's got some ingenuity to her, you know. She's got some parts of the story is devoted to Lana sort of, you know, being a sleuth as well. But here she's just a messenger girl passing off this message to Misty. And then, you know, Misty herself is treated as having some Nancy Drew-like qualities. You know, she is a handwriting expert. She's well-read. But unlike Batgirl in the first story, these skills are not exploited. It's only used to sort of further the story along to make her deduce that Clark is Superboy, which is ridiculous. She couldn't have probably done this without the super teacher, you know, implanting. Yeah, because think about it. Her whole premise is that Clark's handwriting shows a confident, assertive person, but his personality in school reflects someone who's got low self-esteem, so therefore he must be Superboy. What?
Yeah, that's absolutely insane.
So that is part of my, you know, DC don'ts here, because basically that illogical part of the plot, but also based around the fact that Misty is being, you know, forced to have qualities that mean nothing, you know, in the overall thing, because it's all down to the super teacher being the one who gives her all of these, you know, detection skills and allows her to suss out the true identity of Superboy. So, you know, that. Right. And then, of course, the reprehensible part where they sort of sleep together, but it's not really, you know, Misty's will, because she doesn't know what's happening to her. She's under hypnosis. Yeah, so that part's very, very problematic. I hate that they included that. They could have done without that, right, Billy? They could have had them fall in love, but not had them have a sexual relationship under hypnosis.
Yeah.
They could have easily not, but, you know, obviously they didn't show anything happening, but it definitely happened. We know that for a fact.
It's implied for sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, yeah. So this is even, yeah, more implied than Nick Fury's handgun, you know, in his holster. You know what I'm talking about, Steranko, that panel.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously they could have done without that. Anyway, that's my DC don'ts here. Well, with that being said, I guess we're ready to head on into our next segment, which is simply called Bronze Age Blasphemy.
What have you done in here?
We created a life.
You made her?
Yes. Dead pieces of this. My hands. I created what no man's mind or woman's womb could ever hope to achieve.
Blasphemy!
Blasphemy? Before what god? A god repulsed by the miserable humanity he created in his own image? I will not be shackled by the failures of your god. The only blasphemy is to wallow in insignificance. I have taken refuse of your god's failures, and I have triumphed. There is my creation.
All right, listeners, we're back. This is our segment called simply Blasphemy. Yes, this is our Blasphemy segment straight from the Bronze Age. We're ready for some Bronze Age blasphemous statements here. Billy, I'm going to go first because, you know, after all, I'm the one who proposed this specific topic that we're going to be talking about. This topic is twofold. The first one, the first topic entails an artist, and this might make us lose some status in the comic book community, but I don't care because I've been wanting to say this for a while. I mean, there might be some people out there who hate other artists. You know, there might be some guys doing some Marvel podcasts, crazy Marvel podcasts, where they say they hate people like, I don't know, somebody that, like Gil Kane or something. I don't know. But for me, you know, in DC especially, it's always been this guy. I can't stand his art. I've never been able to stomach his art. Maybe his early Silver Age stuff was good, but I just actively don't buy a comic when I see him as the penciler. And that is the man that we've discussed earlier himself, Carmine Infantino. This guy, I really cannot stomach his line work. I mean, people do say he's a genius. Yes, he's a part of the Silver Age. He's a part of comics' resurgence after, you know, the great comic book scare, you know, when everybody in the 50s was burning comic books. Yes, I know he had a big part to play. He was an editor at DC. He was influential. He brought a lot of people in the business. He co-created iconic characters. I understand that. But personally, my opinion on art, not counting for much, but just being what it is, I don't buy comics penciled by Carmine Infantino. Now, you might think, why did I end up buying Batman Family number 2? Well, I bought it in bulk, so it was part of the deal. But also, that comic book's not that bad. That's a little bit of the art of his style that I can kind of stomach. The rest, though, his work on Flash in the late Bronze Age. Early Flash, of course, in the Silver Age was fine. I liked his art there, but his work on Flash, his later work for Marvel, he completely ruined the later issues of Nova for me. Spider-Woman, when he did Spider-Woman, the early issues of Spider-Woman, when she had her first title, it was horrible. I couldn't stand it. I think he even did a few Ms. Marvel issues there for a while. I didn't like them. And Billy, you said, obviously, you agreed with me off mic a little bit because you said you don't like his stuff on Avengers.
Yeah.
Carmine Infantino, man. I'm sorry, listeners. This is the bulk of our blasphemy here. I really don't like his art. Write in. Let us know. I mean, Billy, where was the first time that you... I think you agree with me a little bit on this one, right?
For sure, yeah. The first time I ever saw his art was on Avengers. And I think it's like the late 180s, 190s issue numbers. And I thought it was pretty bad. And I don't remember if I think some of them he might have actually inked himself, but I just didn't understand because Marvel had a pretty good stable of artists at the time, and you would think Avengers would be one of their, you know, top tier books. Maybe it was starting to fall at that point, but yeah, it was pretty bad. I mean, like you said, I have a trade of the early Flash after they brought him back in, what was it, 1956 or something like that around there? Is that when Flash, they changed it and brought him back?
Yeah, 1957, 58. Yeah, 50, yeah, 57.
Somewhere, yeah, somewhere in there. I have a trade, and it's, you know, got the, I think it was what, Showcase?
Showcase Presents. Yeah, Showcase, yeah. Presents, yeah.
And that stuff's fine. You know, I have no problem with that stuff at all. I thought it was actually pretty good. But yeah, man, ever since the late Silver and Bronze Age, I just, oof. Yeah, his stuff's just not for me.
Yeah. Apparently, he was also not a very nice, you know, editor there for a while in the late 60s and 70s. He was very heavy-handed, but nothing like, you know, Mort Weisinger or Jim Shooter was, but he was also not a very nice man for a while there. But, you know, I haven't read too many interviews with him or about him to completely put the pin in that one. But, you know, definitely his art style, you know, we can all have an opinion about art. Some people say there's no bad art. It just depends on how you interpret the art. Okay, his art isn't bad. You know, he can definitely pencil me under the table. You know, of course, he's much better. You know, so how dare I say something about his art? I'm just saying, for me, I don't like looking at it. So I'm not going to buy the comic. It's actually that bad for me, right, Billy? I mean, the story might be great. Of course, I have picked up a lot of his work over the years. There's been some backup tales penciled by him in comics that I loved. Most notably, the Dial H for Heroes stuff he did as backup tales in other comics. I liked some of that stuff. His Dial H for Hero is not, you know, unreadable. There's good Infantino, kind of like they say there's good Howard Chaykin, there's bad Chaykin, right? There's, for me, there is good Infantino, but most of the time I would say that his stuff is so off-putting for me. Just the way he draws the shapes of the characters, the faces, those sharp kind of Robin Hood-esque noses, those, yeah. You know, the way he draws the Flash running. I don't mind the speed lines. The speed lines for me is infinitely better than the lightning effect that the modern day Flash has, which I hate. Now, I'm nitpicking here. Sorry, listeners. But hey, that's what the blasphemy segment's all about. But, you know, the way he draws characters and the way he draws hair, like his hair almost never evolves. It's always this thick, wavy kind of fringes that he draws for the men with this sort of tuft in the back. And his woman can be really sexy. I mean, the way he drew Barbara Gordon as a librarian, you know, as this kind of like, you know, prurient kind of, you know, esque businesswoman, that he can draw really good woman. I like the way he draws eyebrows. But the overall effect of his art, the way he draws anatomy especially, you know, I don't like. And poses. His poses are way off. You know,
that's
when
the big one.
Yeah, the poses are the big deal for me. You agree with that, right?
Yeah, like you said, that one, like the funny part where Batman falls into the swamp in that issue is hilarious, but the sequence of panels make no sense. You know, the way, and then the way Batman's posed and then punching the guy, and then in the very next one where he's falling into the water face first, it makes absolutely no sense. It looks like, the more you look at it, the more you think, wow, that really sucks. Like, that was not a good panel layout, not a good transition from panel to panel. It's not good at all.
Yeah. So you see, listeners, you know, as you know, the blasphemy segment is, we don't just want to hate on things. Comics is about love. We love comics. But, you know, every now and then, when I read a comic that I want to read because of the bizarreness that we're so fond of talking about here on Into the Bazaar, Into the Bizarroverse, of course we have to sometimes talk about a comic which features an artist we might not like. Now, I really don't like this guy, so I have to mention it. I'm not going to be dishonest and not say anything about it.
Sure.
But Carmine Infantino, definitely one of those guys who kind of ruined some of my favorite titles for me over the years, just on art alone. Like, I already mentioned them, Ms. Marvel, Spider-Woman, Nova. They started off with other artists, and then he took over. And from then on, it was like, okay, I'm done with this. Sorry, I'm not continuing with this at all. So, you know, another thing that bugs me, this is now a very small nitpick, is when he draws a punch, not always, but most of the times, especially his later, you know, early 80s kind of pencils that he did, especially on The Flash, when one of his characters punches someone, the punch effect would be so great, so big, that it takes over half of the panel. You know what I mean, Billy? Whereas when you have someone like Sal Buscema over at Marvel drawing a punch, he doesn't even need to draw this explosion. He just draws the swing. The impact is there. It's felt because of how the person being hit reacts. But Carmine Infantino, when his characters get hit, the person who gets hit looks like he's falling asleep, but he doesn't look like his body is conforming to the momentum generated by this blow that's landed on him. You know what I mean? He just looks like he's lying there, you know, suspended in suspended animation. But, you know, the impact of the punch, you know, swallows half of the panel, you know, according to Carmine Infantino. That always bugged me. I was like, you know, show a little bit more dynamic movement. You know, it looks like everybody's got like metal rods inserted into their spines. And you hardly ever see any of these, you know, the folks bending over and muscles being stretched the way you would see like someone like John Buscema doing or one of those guys. So, you know, but whatever. I'm not comparing him to other artists. I'm just laying that out there, listeners, just to be honest with you. Carmine Infantino, not one of my favorites. In fact, one of my least favorites. So that's our blasphemy, the first part of our blasphemy segment out of the way. Now, I'm still not done assaulting the ears of the listeners here, Billy, because the second part, you and I are definitely going to come to blows over this part. I'm just going to throw this statement out there. I don't like modern day Batman. In fact, I don't like dark Batman. I don't like brooding Batman. I don't like Batman to have any serious stories whatsoever. I have always and always will be a fan of Silver Age Batman and the Batuzzi, you know, Batman, the Batman TV show from the 60s. I love that. That's the Batman I was introduced to as a kid. And, you know, I never read a lot of Batman titles, Detective Comics and stuff in the 70s. I read Batman in Brave and the Bold, you know, where he is a little bit kooky. Sometimes he would be serious, yeah, but not most of the time, no. You know, he would be like Silver Age Batman, you know, Batman, you know, as created and conceived by, you know, the guys in the Silver Age. He yeah. would be, you know, the Batman who sometimes changes the color of his suit to be Rainbow Batman. Or he would be Batman who travels into outer space. He would be Batman who dealt with monsters. I'm talking here DC World's Finest from the 60s, where he teams up with mm-hmm. Superman. That was my kind of Batman. I like that kooky Batman. That's why I completely love the Batman the Brave and the Bold animated series from a couple of years back, right, Billy? I love it to yeah. bits. That's the Batman I like. I don't like Frank Miller Batman. I like Grant Morrison Batman a little bit, especially Batman Incorporated stuff. But no, thank you. I don't like dark, brooding Batman. Because for me, that Batman doesn't make sense. Because, I mean, he's a vigilante like the Punisher, and yet he doesn't kill his foes. It would make more sense if he did kill, if he's dark and brooding Batman. You know what I mean? But for me, sure. the Batman that I love is the Batman from the Silver Age, where he's in a superhero universe. So he reacts to superhero stories the way any other hero would. He's not in his own universe like the dark Batman is in Gotham, where all of his foes are leveled to be on his skill set and his fighting prowess. You know, because it seems like only Gotham has villains that are, you know, powered to be on Batman's level. You know what I mean? Whereas right. in every other city, you've got Green Lantern villains, Coast City, you've got Flash villains. They're all powered to be on a superhero level. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, Billy, that's my biggest blasphemy that I'm throwing out here. I don't like Year One Batman. I don't like Dark Knight Returns Batman. I like the stories fine, you know, because it's essentially an Elseworlds tale. But I don't know right. what I don't like what Batman became after that. You know, being all dark. And, you know, this is now a big part of this blasphemy. I wasn't a big fan of the Batman Michael Keaton movie, the first Batman. I was a fan a little bit of Batman 2, you know, Tim Burton's second iteration, because it became crazy, right? It became really crazy. Right. The first one was still serious, dealing with the loss of his parents and how that traumatized him, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know, Billy, that's just me, man. I love Silver Age Batman. I love Batman, but I don't love modern, dark Batman. So what are you going to say? Is our partnership now officially done? What's going to happen to Into the Bizarreverse in the future now? Lay it on me.
Well, I'll tell you what. Batman, I love kooky Batman stories as well. But I do have a love for... I do like Detective, but I do like Brave and the Bold the best, too, as far as Batman, because... Like, some of my favorite ones are where he teams up. There's one where he teams up with Sergeant Rock. And they have to go after this mystery man who Sergeant Rock says is Adolf Hitler. And Batman's like, you idiot, it can't be him. He's dead. And
I remember
Rock's
that one.
Like, he's yeah. not, man.
That was crazy.
And, you know, the cover has Batman brandishing a cross like Peter Cushing chasing after Dracula. It's great. So those are my favorites, too. So there are a little wacky... But they're still pretty serious Batman. But for me, Batman, I don't like any post like 1982, 1983 Batman. That's just too crazy to me. He went over a line.
Billy,
I'm not ever gonna, ever cross. I don't like those Batman yet. Except there's one exception, the Batman cartoon from the 90s.
Oh yeah, of course.
Pretty brooding in there, but there would always be humor, you know, humorous moments in there too to kind of lighten things up. So that Batman, love it. But other than that, like, I do have some more. I don't know if you'd consider it modern age Batman and stuff like that that I've read and I thought was decent. Didn't love it, liked it, but didn't love it. But definitely my Batman is, you know, Brave and the Bold Batman for sure. And like you said, the cartoon Brave and the Bold, oh my gosh, that was hilarious.
You
loved
know,
every minute of it.
Billy, I'm impressed. You brought the blasphemy home, man. You said there are no good Batman stories that you like, at least after 1982. I feel exactly the same because... Not because the stories weren't well written or anything. I mean, there was this one that I read, penciled by Jim Aparo and written by Jim Starlin. You know, the Ten Nights of the Beast? You know, that was in the late 1980s, I think 1987. I like that one fine, but that was like a Punisher-type story because Batman actually kills the guy at the end. You know, he locks him up. He locks him up forever in this, like, you know, abandoned train station where he can't get out, where he's going to starve to death. And that was like a Punisher type story for me. And that made more sense for dark, brooding Batman, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, I do like Bernie Wrightson's interpretation, the Batman gothic kind of, you know, stuff. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that, you know. And then, you know, I also like it when they put Batman in an Elseworlds tale, you know, where Batman is a vampire. And in fact, you know, mm-hmm. the early Gene Colan Batman issues where he dealt with vampires, that was great because you and I, we love Colan. Yeah. And I love that because, you know, that is for me a story where you can see serious, darker Batman in. But, you know, then there were also some Brave and the Bold issues where Batman had, you know, a team up with Andrew Bennett from iVampire from the House of Mystery comics. And then, you know, he would react like a Silver Age Batman would, you know, he would deal with vampires in a way that the Silver Age Batman would deal, you know, like he has crosses and stuff ready and his utility belt and stuff, you know, so I like that. But, you know, I just want to make this clear to the listeners. I'm a huge Batman fan, but the Batman from the 1960s, clearly, and from the early 1970s, I'd say before Neil Adams, in that Ra's al Ghul story where Batman was stabbed and almost killed by Ra's al Ghul, before that, I would say that Batman and the Batman we have now, they're, and everybody would agree with me here, Billy, they're completely different characters.
Oh, for sure.
They're completely different.
Yeah, they're not even close. And like you said, too, like I have one of the volumes of World's Finest, hardcover, Volume 3 and Archive Edition, and it's insane, but I love it. Like you said, you know, there's a story where there's, like, you know, Batman and Superman are fighting a caveman Superman.
Yes.
Where he has all the powers of Superman. It's crazy. It makes no sense.
Come on, there's stories in the World's Finest where Batmite teams up with Mr. Mixes Pitlick and then causes problems for the World's Finest crew. I mean, those stories, I love them. I love them because I love positive, upbeat Batman. I love the Batman that can crack a smile or have some wry humor every now and then. Now, I'm not saying that I don't obviously like Batman the Animated Series because, like you say, they did have a little bit of humor. Batman doesn't have to be all about humor. It can have serious stories, of course. I mean, lots of Silver Age stories had some serious moments too. It wasn't all Silver Age craziness, right? But I'm thinking stuff like, you know, the death of Lightning Lad and the Legion of Superheroes. You really felt it, you know, even though it's a Silver Age crazy story. There's lots of examples in the Silver Age of that. But, you know, what I'm saying is having Batman always dark and brooding only works if you're going to play him off against other characters who are not like that, like in the Justice League International stuff. I could handle Batman being dark and broody because then it was used as a means of furthering, you know, the dynamic in the team, you know?
Right.
But you know, I really don't like modern Batman. I don't like this dark shit. I want Batman who can crack a smile. Justice League, Bronze Age Justice League Batman was great for me. I like him. He's not dark. He's not brooding. He doesn't have all the crazy Silver Age gadgets, but he does have that sense of, okay, I'm going to get things done my way because I'm the smartest in the team, you know, even smarter than Superman. And they play off of that. Now, they still do that sometimes in modern Justice League stories. Batman is still one of the smartest ones, but not as much as they used to do back then, Billy.
No.
Now it's all about how good he is, you know, how he can take on a foe who's tougher than him, you know, physically one-on-one. Yeah, I'm fine with that. But don't tell me Batman can take on Darkseid. Come on. You know, I mean, if Silver Age Batman could definitely take on Darkseid, and in fact, he did in the Batman the Brave and the Bold cartoon, and he did it well. You know, because he's got all of his Silver Age gadgets, the utility belt still meant something. Now the utility belt doesn't mean a lot. Now it's the whole suit. You know, it's almost like an Iron Man-esque Batman now. I don't like that. Still, whatever, we're complaining, we're blaspheming here, but that's what it's about, right, listeners? That's what it's about. Mm-hmm. So, Billy, that's our bit of Bronze Age blasphemy. Hope we didn't already lose half of our listenership here, but, you know, we'll just blame it on, like you say, the super teacher from Krypton, temporarily hypnotizing Herman Highfather Low here, so I apologize in advance. Anyway, that brings us to our next segment, Billy, your baby, and that one is called
The Endorsements of Etrigan.
That's right, we're going to be recommending some good books to you folks right after this break. Don't go away.
Warmest greetings, mortal slime, from the depths of the burning mire. Perk up your ears to my scorching rhyme, or slake my thirst with blood and hellfire. Two hosts there be, two corpses for me, if their recommendations prove flawed. I spit on their graves, these ignorant knaves, if their counsel you fail to applaud. First comes the Billy One, ego ablaze with books he thinks will awe and amaze. A warning for him, trust not in hope, else I'll string him up by the nards, 'tis no joke. Next comes the loud-mouthed one, who dares to insult my friends Infantino and Kane. I'll toss him into a hellish tumult once I tire of this podcasting game. Not worthy of a name, yet I call him Pee-wee. His accent is crude, I'll confess. His recommendations might make children go wee-wee, but me, they've always failed to impress. If these books disappoint, and the show is a bomb, drop me a line over at etrigan.com. Throw a Gmail in there for added good measure, and I promise I'll torture the hosts at my leisure. And now, farewell. I have said enough. I leave you with beating hearts all aflutter. There are souls to reap, life's candles to snuff, in purgatory where the black whispers mutter. And so I must leave you, you gibbering wrecks, for another Bizarroverse show's in the can. But wear the nighttime breeze on your necks, for it might just be the breath of Etrigan.
All right, we're back with the endorsements of Etrigan. What does Etrigan have this week for us, Billy? What's he going to recommend? What do you have on the slate?
Well, after that last segment, you're going to love me, because I have Tales of the Batman by Steve Englehart.
Dark-ish from what I remember. Oh, is that
it's
one of the...
Too bad. It's the one where it's like it starts out with him and he's got it's him and Walt Simonson and I think Milgram on the inks and then it's a couple of wacky stories with like Dr. Phosphorus and stuff like that and
I like that one
and then it goes into the Steve Englehart, Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin stuff there. I mean, it wasn't a long run, but I enjoy it. You know, I just got this hardcover not too long ago, and it's heavy stuff, but then, you know, he's got his relationship with Silver St. Cloud, and then the Joker three-parter, you know, the Joker fish. Oh, it's pretty good stuff. So it's not too bad. It hasn't really gone off the deep end yet of that super broody, crazy Batman. So.
No. This is the Batman I can read. I like this Batman. I especially like the art. You know, guys like Marshall Rogers, guys like Gene Colan on Batman. You know, these guys were... they were legends for me, and they penciled Batman so well, better than they did other superheroes. So, you know, I love him. I really, really love him. Obviously, Gene Colan penciled, you know, other stuff great too. You know, he wasn't just great on Batman, but, you know, guys like Marshall Rogers and Don Newton, you know, I will always associate them with Batman. You know, there's no way that I can think of, and of course, Jim Aparo. You know, Jim Aparo for me is like a master. He's one of my top five favorite artists of all time. There's no way that I cannot include him when I think Batman. But yeah, Billy, I can go with this. No, don't worry. This is I'm still loving you here, bud. I'm still loving you. The love's still strong here, because I do like this Batman. I sort of put him in the Silver Age kind of esque mentality. Still a little bit of it. So any particular standouts in this collection? I know these collections are fairly new, right? They've been putting them out regularly over the last couple of years, but they've been recently doing the Colan Volume 1, 2, 3. They've got the Don Newton one, the Marshall Rogers one, and now they've got the Steve Englehart one, or has it been around for a while?
Well, no, this one just came out. It was supposed to come out either late last year or earlier, way earlier this year, but because of the coronavirus and all that crap,
yeah,
it just actually came out, like, maybe it was late July. And, yeah, so brandy new. It was like a $50 book, but I got it for, I think, like $34, like $15 oh, nice. Off the cover. Yeah, so not bad from Amazon. And, yeah, like I said, it's just, you know, it starts out with, you know, you get a lot of that background stuff with Rupert Thorne, and he's going crazy because he thinks Hugo Strange, the ghost of Hugo Strange, is trying to get him. And that's kind of funny, too. But, yeah, oh, man, just like you said, the Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin artwork is crazy good. Like, I was just blown away by it.
Yeah, no. I have fond memories of that era of Batman. Of course, you know, being a kid from South Africa, I didn't have the luxury of picking them up on the regular because we would have sporadic issues. But I picked up a couple of issues here and there. Like any superhero kid back then, of course, I did read Batman. I am a Batman fan. And that was early, you know, 80s, late 1970s kind of fare. So I would definitely pick up every issue I could find. You know, like there was this Batman issue I used to love as a kid where it's a Christmas issue where he saves a girl who was trying to commit suicide from Blockbuster. But Blockbuster, you know, obviously also tried to kind of had this Beauty and the Beast thing going with this girl. And, you know, I just, ever since then, I've been a Batman fan. You know, I'm just not a fan of modern Batman. But this is definitely a collection I want to pick up because Englehart, man, we love Englehart. In fact, if I could, if we could do another podcast, Billy, I would definitely want to focus on Englehart's stuff that he wrote for Marvel. But obviously, that's a pipe dream. But still, you know. Woo! Deep cut. All right. So, anyway, so that's it. Any other things to mention about that volume, or can I head on into mine?
Yeah, go ahead, brother.
Okay, Billy. Now, okay, I don't know about you, but obviously we're DC fans here. We like Marvel, but, you know, DC's our primary kind of thing here. So when we were kids, DC got us into this whole comic fandom thing. I don't know if you can remember the very first series that you collected in its entirety, the one that you completed. Can you remember that series, or is that a bit of a tall order?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that one.
Okay, so this is mine. Obviously, you know, this is the first series ever I collected from issue 1 up to 31. Now, it wasn't a month. I didn't monthly buy it. You know, obviously, but this was the first series I, you know, went and tried to collect. And I did, in fact, collect it from issue 1 to issue 31. That's as long as the series lasted, and it only had one annual. And this was in the very early 1980s, although I only ended up, you know, filling up this series in the early 1990s, 10 years after I started collecting it. And this was a series from DC, Billy. Issue 1 to 31, which I recently reread over the summer holidays. Blue Devil. Do you know that series? Okay.
Yeah, I've never read it, but yep, I've seen it. And most people I know, they said they enjoyed it quite a bit.
Oh, man, I love this series so much. I loved it. I loved this as a kid. I still love it. I've reread it countless times. Now, it's been a couple of years since I've reread it, you know. But, you know, the other day I was like, tooling around my long boxes, and I found it, and I was like, okay, I gotta get this series out, I gotta give it a reread. And it's only 31 issues, you know, they go fast. Written by Dan Mishkin, penciled by Paris Cullens. He did a lot of great work on the DC Who's Who in the DC Superheroes issues as well. You know, I love Paris Cullens' art, and it's so suitable for this character. Now, I don't know about the listeners if they know who this guy is, but basically Dan Cassidy, stunt master supreme. He also invents his own stunt equipment. He's working on a movie called Blue Devil, so he invents this suit, this super suit, which makes him look like a devil, obviously intended for him as the stuntman, but obviously for the main actor as well. And this suit gives him various abilities, but all, you know, obviously tailored to fit into the movie, you know. So it gives him like super strength so that he can perform, you know, stunts that he couldn't usually perform. This is not like Tony Stark Iron Man, folks. He's not trying to fight crime here. He's a movie stuntman, you know, engineer. So Dan invents the suit to look like the main character of this movie. They're shooting Blue Devil. And they shoot this movie on an island where, unknowing to the crew and everybody, there is a gateway to a hell dimension inhabited by a demon called Nebiros. That's right, folks. Nebiros' gateway to his dimension is over there. They unwittingly set him free. He grabs Dan. Dan obviously dons the suit to combat this monster, because none of the poor humans running around has any, you know, ability at all to resist this giant demon who looks crazy. He looks like an ant, a giant ant, but with a face with expressions on him. And, you know, he grabs Dan, and he also grabs Dan's trident, this trident he invented for this movie, you know, obviously. And this trident has various abilities. It has power blasts and stuff like that. It can serve as a sort of like a witch's broom and, you know, rocket you around if it needs. It can be a mode of transportation. You can throw it like Captain America's shield, you know, it can rocket back to you, and it can be like that, kind of like a projectile weapon. So, you know, Nebiros, he's very impressed with this little devil-looking guy who's kind of sort of almost giving him a run for his money as he's trying to snack on these poor humans on this island. So, you know, he grabs Blue Devil and he calls him brother, little brother. And he says, you know, you've been too long in the world of mortals. I'm going to give you a gift. And he blasts him with these eye beams. And Dan thinks he's done for, right? That's it, right? But he manages to, after being blasted by these eye beams, to recover, and he knocks Nebiros back into the portal and closes the portal. And then, job well done, he saves the day. He tries to take off the suit. As it turns out, Nebiros has fused the suit to his body permanently. In fact, to his DNA on a molecular level. So he's literally become a Blue Devil.
Wow.
So that is the story. And after that, you know, it's kind of like a Ben Grimm kind of scenario where he's stuck in this suit and he's trying to be human, but he can't because he can't get the suit off. He's got problems with his girl, who's like this famous actress. He's got problems with, you know, his family. They won't accept him. He's got problems in real life because people keep thinking he is now a real life superhero, and they keep supervillains keep hunting him down to try their luck with this new hero on the scene. He doesn't want to be a superhero. He just wants to get the suit off. It's just great, man. He fights Metallo at one point in time. He fights his own villain, Shockwave. There's a villain called Bolt that's being introduced. There is Nebiros coming back from the Hell Dimension because Dan gets Zatanna from the Justice League satellite to get him to go with him to the island to beg Nebiros to reverse his spell. Oh man, Zatanna develops a romantic relationship with him at one point in time. It's crazy. Oh man, and this only 30 lasted for only 31 issues, and you know, one annual, but I've got them all. I love them. I reread them every couple of years. It's just a great series, man. So I want to recommend this to the readers. They're fairly easy to find. Blue Devil by Dan Mishkin and Paris Collins. Inked, Billy, by one of your favorites from the old Monster Magazine days, Pablo Marcos. Most of the time.
Yeah, crazy good artist. Crazy good.
Oh, love him. Love him. And love everything about this series. So check him out, folks. Check out this series. Blue Devil from DC. It's from the 1980s. You know, I think it lasted from 1984 to 1986, and then it was done. But such a good time. Such a good time. And, you know, right after that, right after completing my Blue Devil, I completed only the second series ever that I've collected in its entirety, and that was the Omega Men, you know, from DC as well. So, you know.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that one. Yep.
Those ones were fairly easy to complete because not a lot of folks were buying their issues, and they seemed to be readily available, at least in South Africa, where I was, like, plumbing the short boxes and long boxes in flea markets and stuff. And, you know, also Fury of Firestorm. Right after that, I collected the volume 2 of the Fury of Firestorm by Jerry Conway. I collected them. They were easy to come by, even though that ran into the 50s, you know. But Blue Devil was easy, you know, just 31 issues plus an annual. Anyway, folks, so that's my bit of, you know, endorsements of Etrigan for you. Pick those series up and definitely pick up the Engelhardt Batman volume. I'm going to do so right after we finish recording here, Billy. I'm going to order it on Amazon. Love Engelhardt. All right, folks, that brings us to the end of yet another episode of Into the Bizarroverse. We'll leave you with our contact details and where you can find us on the interwebs. I'll let you go first. Billy, where can the folks reach you on the net?
So definitely look for me on Twitter. That's where I'm heaviest presence. It's at BillyD_Licious. And then my blog, magazinesandmonsters.com, and podcast as well. And then there is a Facebook page by the same name, Magazines and Monsters.
That's right. And you can find me at Dark Longbox, also on Twitter. Yeah, and if you want to check out any additional blog posts, do so. I'll leave the blog a link on the show notes, and you can have some a peek at some of the images we discussed, right, Billy? So that's where you can find us, folks. Join us for our Twitter conversations. It's a blast. All right, well, Billy, Into the Bizarreverse has to say goodbye yet again. We're heading off back to our cube-shaped world, leaving the listeners to have a bit of a breather, but definitely to read some good comics, hopefully. So we'll be back, but we'll leave you with a small message. Bizarre is cool. Bizarre is fun. You should be bizarre. Don't feel bad about your bizarreness. Revel in it and share it with the world. And share it with Into the Bizarreverse. And we'll be here again next time for another episode. So for me, that's bye-bye.
All right, stay bizarre, people.
Take care. Cheerio. The same.